Welcome back to the Clean Sailors Podcast. Let's talk about sailing, our marine industry, and innovations towards getting it clean. I'm your host, Holly, founder of Clean Sailors and a sailor myself with a passion for the health of our mighty oceans. Through conversations with innovators, inventors, adventurers, and inspirational sailors, we're looking at those who are helping to change the way things are done. Okay, she's back. I'm joined again by Ella Hibbett, who you may remember from a podcast episode we did earlier in 2024. Ella is gearing up for a solo Arctic Circle, attempting the world's first single-handed non-stop circumnavigation of the Arctic, but also importantly raising awareness of the environmental challenges that we have going on up north. Ella, it's so good to see you again.
Thanks for having me back.
So what was the purpose of this year's trip?
So this summer's trip was really about trialing and testing both the yacht and myself. Obviously, Yeva underwent quite an extensive refit for the first half of 2024, from January up until sort of June, July. So it was about getting out there and making sure the boat was up to the standards we're looking for, making sure that I loved single-handing as much as I was hoping I would, and also trying to push north and start raising awareness for the campaign that we're building and showcasing the reasons why I'm doing what I'm doing.
So this was a test run in every sense. The boat, yourself, the passage, just getting a sort of understanding of the, in some ways, I imagine also like the weather systems.
Yeah, absolutely. All of the above, really. It was just time for Yeva and I to get out there and put our money where our mouth was, you know, and do everyone proud and show the sponsors that we're all heading the right way and getting geared up for next year's attempt.
What were you perhaps most aware of or nervous about before you left for this test run?
I think how I was going to handle sleep deprivation and being offshore alone. I mean, I've had every confidence in the boat from the get-go, but this was my first sort of extensive single-handed trip. So yeah, I'm glad that I took to that as well as I was hoping I would.
I think the important thing is, right, as you said, smart to do the test run on every level, but also the fact that you've come back and you are still gearing up to go next year, because I appreciate objectively, there is always the opportunity for people to say, do you know what, that was enough. But you're really raring to go for the...
Yeah, I think that was a part concern, mostly probably from my family, that I might turn around after doing what I did this summer and say, actually, I hated that and I don't want to do it again. But it was quite the opposite. I loved every moment, even when things were less than ideal. I was still loving it. So yeah, Theo was back in the yard and fixing up a couple of issues we found this summer, which is helpful in hindsight because those who have been following the campaign from the beginning might know that the original plan was to attempt the circumnavigation this summer before postponing to be able to get these trials done. And without doing that, I would have encountered some issues during the circumnav that probably would have hindered our attempt at it. So yeah, we're fixing all of those up and yeah, definitely just excited to get back out there. I've been on land for about 4 weeks now and I've had enough already.
I mean, just I want to be really clear also, right? If you had done that and if anyone has attempted or done the trial run and then decided it's not for them, that's completely legit, right? I mean, it's just very impressive that this is something that genuinely hasn't been done before, what you're attempting. And so not only is it super prudent and obviously smart, but also just that exercise of extending yourself into that physical environment on your own. I mean, it gives me goose pimples again, so many times that we talk, because it really is exceptional. It's exceptional in terms of the adventurousness and obviously the ingenuity of everything you're doing to prepare your boat, etc. But also because it is genuinely uncharted to the extent that no one has yet managed to do what you're looking to achieve next year. So it's no small feat, Ella. Just going to say it like that.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it isn't. But it's, I think, the way that I recognize it is slightly different to how it must be seen for people looking in on what's going on. So, you know, if I allow myself time to sit and think about how nuts it probably is, then it wouldn't be being done. So it's all very modular at the moment, keeping everything compartmentalized, working through the list of what I need to do between now and next year, and just keeping focused rather than getting caught up in how extreme of an event it might be or thinking about what happens when I get back from it. It's one step at a time.
I remember actually talking on your boat before you left about things like sleep deprivation, because also solo sailing, that's obviously a big concern or let's say opportunity for self-awareness. How did you manage that in the end? And is that still something that you feel most aware of or very aware of or nervous about still going forward?
I don't feel as nervous about it anymore, no. So when I sailed this year, we sailed up the Norwegian coast, Jeva and I, to Tromso, and then sailed from Tromso to Svalbard and Svalbard back to Tromso. So those two crossings of the Barents Sea were 7 days each. And at no point in either crossing did I sleep for more than 20 minutes at a time. So I found pretty quickly that 20 minutes was the right time for me, 15 or 25 or 30. I would wake up either not rested enough or too groggy. So 20 minutes was really the perfect number. And I found it much easier to get into the pattern of sleeping 20 minutes at a time than to get out of it once I got back to land. Like I said, I only pursued it up to a week at a time, but I feel like I could push that to about 10 days if I had to. You know, a lot of next year's circumnavigation is going to be coastal, and there will be opportunities in periods of open water to hove to and get longer sleeps, or if needs be, to drop the hook or attach to an ice floe or do whatever else I need to not have to push that 7 day to 10 day sort of limit. But I'm confident that I could do a week at a time if needs be of those 20 minute sleep cycles. So definitely pleased I got to test those.
Also that you found your medium, right? Because it's easy to say, well, you know, you'll read books like there's a fantastic one on extreme, you know, it's how people sort of go into environments where they are, you are stretching your natural body rhythms or otherwise. And you almost can't write it and say, actually, you can manage it, say, 2 hours or 20 minutes or 10 minutes. The fact that you found your personal optimum, I think, is so important, isn't it? Because that's what your body needs. That's what your mind needs enough for you to continue and sort of be rested, but certainly just aware and alert.
You know, 20 minutes won't work for everybody, but it works for me. And if I can get enough 20 minutes that I'm averaging anywhere between 3 to 4 hours of sleep in a 24-hour period, then I'm pretty good. If I'm not getting enough 20-minute naps that I'm getting sort of less than 2 hours sleep every 24 hours, then I'll start to struggle. But that sort of 3 to 4 hour in a 24-hour period seems to work quite well. And then obviously more if you can, and in the crack on if you can't.
And what were you surprised at? And perhaps what were you genuinely not prepared for in this test run?
I think on the crossing to Svalbard from Tromso, in the middle of the Barents Sea, Jeva suffered total steerage failure and flooding to the floorboards. Now, I'd had issues with the steering that I'd sort of jury-rigged on and off as we went, and I'd had the flooding, and I'd never had both happen at the same time. So the issues there were two parts. So the flooding stemmed from the fact that the anchor locker didn't have any outboard drainage. It had a drainage pipe that led to the bilges inside the boat. So Jeva's got a hollow keel, which is 1.75 meters of draft, which is a lot of water for a 38-foot boat to get stuck in the bilges. So what we didn't realise, with neither of the other owners having particularly done any sort of heavy weather offshore sailing, like the 5 meters I was in the Barents, was we didn't realise quite how much water that was going to let in, to the point where the bilge pumps were sort of pumping all the time consistently, and after 9 or 10 hours would just fail. So that was one half of the issue. And then the other half was the steering, which is kind of hard to explain without drawing it on a piece of paper. But essentially, you've got the rudder shaft and the rudder quadrant. And the rudder quadrant was held to the shaft by a keyway system, like a male-to-female connector, with 4 grub screws to keep it in place. And with the bashing about in seas that heavy, the grub screws weren't enough to hold the quadrant to the shaft. So it slid off of the bottom of that male connector, which meant that, so obviously the hydraulic arm for the autopilot and the manual steering arm for the cockpit helm were both connected to that one rudder quadrant. So total steerage failure of the boat, essentially, at that point. So luckily, in order to mitigate issues like that, I'd already thought of backup systems. So I had the hydrovane on the back of the boat, which I used for 2 days to get Jeva into Longyearbyen and Svalbard. Parking a steel boat on a hydrovane is not something I want to try and do again. But we managed to get in. It was nearly midnight, but it was obviously light because it was the Arctic summer up there. So it wasn't an issue parking her, other than the handling of the boat itself. And then the flooding, obviously I had spare bilge pumps and I could wire those in. But in that particular scenario, it was more of a case of pumping out manually and then steering on hydrovane to avoid the waves coming from the wrong direction back over the bow, because I didn't have enough wind at moments to leave the hydrovane confidently steering whilst I went and started stripping and soldering wires and electrics to get bilge pumps reconnected. So those are the two main issues that Yeva's having fixed at the moment. Actually, they've both been fixed now. That's what we've been working on the last couple of weeks. So she's had a bunch of welding done and drainage holes cut in the bow, and that pipe bunged off that used to lead to the bilges. And we've made a clamp for her steering that'll stop the rudder quadrant coming down again. So yeah, those have been resolved now. So she's ready for a new lick of paint and some anti-foul, and then we'll get her back in the water, hopefully.
I like your challenge to my question because, you know, in asking what weren't you prepared for, it was a very honest and kind of what didn't you know could happen that happened. And it is fascinating that you had all of the preparation and almost the backup to the backups, as you described, but preparing for the two of them coinciding at the same time was, you know, unparalleled. Obviously, it's quite a unique event in any sense for them both to occur at the same time, let alone being solo sailing up in, you know, Northern Europe.
Yeah, it was a bit of an overload to the system that they both happened at the same time. And then, you know, steering on the hydrovane, obviously when there's no wind. So part of the reason that I bought Yeva, obviously, is because of the doghouse to keep me out of the elements. Now coming into Longyearbyen, it was raining, freezing cold sleet. And I was manually steering on the hydrovane under engine to come into port. So sat up on deck, holding onto that hydrovane in everything, every layer that I possibly owned. Pretty cold and miserable. But yeah, I managed to jury-rig a fix to the steering that managed to get us back to Scotland. But ultimately, it was the repeated flooding of the anchor locker into the bilges of the boat that caused me to sort of end the summer sea trials in Scotland and work on getting Yeva back home.
Makes a lot of sense. And as we described, the subsequent stormy weather and prevailing southwesterly nasties that we've had over the last like 2 months makes a lot of sense to focus on the fixes and getting ready for next year.
Yeah, it's about having enough time in the spring to go and sea trial, knowing that I've still got time to come back and reinforce if it's not quite up to standards yet. Hopefully it will be. I mean, now Marine, who have been working on the boat in the yard, have done a cracking job. So not anticipating any more issues, but we'll find out when I come and see you in Falmouth in January.
Yes, storm chasing you will be. But it's still, I mean, I have to say, I was going to ask you, I mean, a very natural question is, so what are some of your highest moments? And arguably, if I'm an outsider sort of listening to you and, you know, seeing in some ways like the seriousness, but also the sort of fondness of which you're talking, Ella, is like, that has to be one of it. I mean, that is in itself such an achievement to be able to pull all of that together, relying entirely on yourself to be able to, you know, get the jury rig sorted and get back to Scotland. And, you know, I appreciate sitting outside in like seemingly minus 10 breezes when it's sleeting and you're like, it's the north coast of Norway. Is a really tough situation to be in. And yet you're, you know, there with your hand on the hydrovane getting yourself into port. I mean, that has to, in some ways, you know, register as a, you know, big achievements and hopefully some really high moments of what you've learned so far.
Yeah, it does. It's one of those things that I need to get better at is probably giving myself a bit of credit when it's due rather than just thinking about what comes next and cracking on. But it was very rewarding to be able to fix the oversteering with what I had on the boat and get her home. Yeah, it was not without its challenges, but I feel like those are the moments when I really came into myself because I just loved it. You know, I sent one of the lads on my shore team a message on the sat phone from the middle of the Barents saying, you know, boats going around in circles, need to investigate steering. And he sent me a text back saying, why don't you have a nap? And then maybe you'll find that it's fine to get a steer. And I was like, as much as I understood his point, he didn't word that very well. He sort of said, I don't need another nap.
I was going to say, did not know
you do a failure, you know. So it was a laugh when I needed it, really. But yeah, no, I loved it. I loved the challenge of it. And seeing, you know, seeing where we got to. I mean, even just going to Svalbard, which isn't really on the routing for next year. So it's somewhere that I'm glad I got to see this summer. But seeing things like wild beluga whales, you know, swimming up the fjord in front of the bow and glaciers and the walruses and the Arctic terns. I mean, it was just an incredible, incredible experience and environment. Yeah, really chuffed with it.
I think also your trip coincided with some of the most spectacular activity of the Aurora Borealis.
Yeah, on the way back from Svalbard, I saw them a couple of times, once off the north coast of Norway, and then once actually coming into Inverness in Scotland, where we finished our sea trials. They were stunning. Obviously, when I was up in Svalbard, that was all Arctic daylight, Arctic summertime. So the night navigation started on the way back, and as did the Northern Lights, which was a good way of keeping you motivated at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, nowhere more spectacular in some ways to be viewing them than on your own, on your boat, on an expedition like that, in the middle of the Northern Sea, I mean, bit of a pinch me moment, I'm sure.
It was definitely an emotional one. Yeah, there might have been a couple of tears shed at that. Yeah, it was stunning.
On that point, Ella, almost like candidly, what were some of the lowest points for you? The things that just either got too much or were frustrating. I mean, appreciate that message from your shorty would have been either you laugh or you cry.
The absolute lowest point was leaving Shetland. The intention when I left Shetland was to sail to the northeastern coast of Scotland and start making my way down the east coast of England to come home. Now, I'd been waiting in Shetland, waiting out some storms to blow over. We had sort of 68 knots of wind out in the North Sea that I certainly wasn't setting sail into. But knowing that Yeva couldn't cope with a lot of water coming over the bow meant, you know, trying to route around as much of the weather and the waves as possible. So Shetland, yeah, with the intention of going to northeast Scotland. And after about 8 or 9 hours of waves on the nose again, found the boat flooded to the floorboards once more. One of the two bilge pumps had failed, not both of them at that point. So I had to make the decision to divert to Fair Isle, which I don't know if anyone listening has been into Fair Isle, but if you have, you'll know that it is an incredibly narrow entrance where you've got a cliff on one side, rocks on the other. And it's pitch black dark. There's no lighting of any buoyage. There's no lighting once you get into the bay. So getting in there in the absolute chucking rain, in between sort of running downstairs to manually pump, back outside onto the steering, trying to get sails down, heading into this bay. Once I got into the breakwater and I was out of the waves, I still couldn't even see the dock that I was supposed to be docking on. And through, you know, my torch, through the rain, couldn't see it either. So I was just sat in the middle of this bay, trying to keep her off of the shallows, trying to get the sails down. So sort of running from the helm station to the sails, to the manual bilge pump, to the helm station to the sails, trying to get fenders out. Until finally these two guys came down to the dock and lit up the floodlights and sort of lit up the dock at about, this must have been about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and came and took my lines and helped get you over ashore. And that was the moment I really sort of felt like I'd had enough. That was quite a spectacle of an evening. So the following morning, I slipped lines at just after 8 and re-diverted to Wick. And then in that crossing, sort of 80 miles to Wick or whatever it was, I managed to keep her more beam onto the swell so she wouldn't flood again. And then waited in Wick for the right conditions to be able to get to Inverness, where we finally put her on a truck for the way home, because the flooding was just, I mean, that was about the fourth time she'd flooded through the anchor locker by that point. So,
I mean, I'm sitting here, no one can see me, but I mean, generally, aghast, and I have got goosebumps, because as a combination of factors, I think most people, I think, would guard against being in this kind of context. Obviously, when you almost are choiceless, let's say, or certainly it's the best choice to be making out of a unpalatable bunch of choices. Well done. I mean, that's bloody good seapersonship. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it was a relief to get her in there safe and sound, and then obviously get us back to mainland safe and sound. But it was quite an intense emotional and sort of physical few days, those ones. So there was a lot going on. But we got there in the end. We got back safe. And
very much. It's incredible. I mean, it's obviously so exciting, yeah, listening to you. But I also appreciate it. I think my threshold may have been a little bit lower than yours. Given that, I probably would have cried at your friend's message, put it out.
That's what, you know, when you haven't got a choice, you've just got to get on with it. And in part, I probably have my dad to thank for that sort of military mindset approach to things. But you deal with it, deal with the emotions later. Just get on, get yourself safe and sorted. And I'm proving to myself that I'm capable of doing that.
Ella, when we were sitting on your boat in the summer, I remember looking at your fantastic charts of literally the Arctic, right? And to the untrained eye, appreciating, obviously, you understand the geography of the sort of system, but we're talking about the sort of literally the apex of the planet, and you know, the way that the wind and the air moves as well as the water isn't like obviously any other coastline on the planet. What did you notice? Like, what was the weather like and the general climate in terms of the temperature and the wind and the precipitation? And is that something that you had expected?
To be honest, both Norway and Svalbard were a lot warmer than I would have ever have anticipated. So in Tromsø, we were walking around in shorts and t-shirts, and Svalbard, just 2 days before I arrived there, reached a record temperature of 22 degrees Celsius this year, which is mad to the extent now where there is current debate happening whether Svalbard is still allowed to be classified as Arctic desert or not, because the warmer temperatures have caused so much precipitation that there's so much more rain and runoff from the snow melting on the mountains and into the fjord, that they are currently redefining sort of whether Svalbard still fits that definition of Arctic desert. It was quite harrowing to see firsthand. Obviously, it's the first time I've been up there, but having videoed and documented what I did and putting it out online, I've received comments from people who would say, you know, we were there 10 years ago and wow, how different does it look now? And, you know, what a shame to see that, you know, the fjords no longer freeze over like they used to. And it was definitely eye-opening in that sense. And then as far as sort of pressure systems, there's definitely more heavy weather in the North Sea in the summer than I was possibly expecting. I was expecting it to probably get worse more towards September, but I was up there in July and August and still having to route around quite a lot of storms, but mostly purely because of the issues with Yeva rather than not being able to be out in those conditions. And, you know, if we look at climate models and things at the moment, we'll see the polar jet stream drifting further south and the whole world of change going on up there that we're keeping an eye on that makes forecasting next year's expedition quite difficult in the sense that there's no sort of prevailing wind that's consistent enough to know that I'll be beating into it for X amount of miles and then sailing downwind for X amount of miles, like we're seeing from the Vendée Globers and stuff. It's a very unusual place to try and predict.
Well, it's already unusual, isn't it? I think, like you said, and then this year, certainly, with it already being unusual just by virtue of its geography on the planet, and we're already seeing, I mean, this year has been incredibly pronounced in terms of odd weather. And I say that in it just bucking the trend effectively. We've had this exceptional high pressure system sitting really high and this band of low pressure whacking Europe. I mean, for most of the year, I mean, you look at places like Italy as early as, say, April, even of March time, just being under deluges of water. So you're combining those two factors, right, of the already changing climate, but also being in the, you know, most unique part of the planet, arguably, for weather systems.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, a lot of next year's expedition is going to be rooted on the go, almost, you know. So there'll be a combination of my shore team at home sending me, you know, updated models and info that they're seeing, but also me using my own eyeballs and common sense and knowledge of what cloud means, what's coming next, and, you know, playing it almost not quite, I don't want to say by ear. There's obviously going to be, you know, planning and support. But yeah, being uber vigilant and updated forecast daily rather than relying on one for a 3-day prediction kind of thing.
I think it's a poignant reminder in some ways about, you know, what your expedition was also to highlight and, you know, describing it firsthand. You know, we initially began this conversation on that very premise around, you know, about our ice caps and how they've been perhaps the biggest, most referred to proxy for the alarming rate of temperature change on our planet. You know, how they've been preserved for millions of years, and now we're seeing exponential increase in the melting. And your description of the sort of Svalbard Arctic desert changing is quite pronounced. I mean, it's these inhospitable and impassable and just somewhat remote and, as you said, desert-like areas are changing incredibly dramatically, and that you were even in northern Norway and could experience that much ahead of even heading up as far as the, you know, into the Arctic Circle proper. I mean, that's quite something. Did that bring it home some way in terms of, you know, the charities that you're supporting and also the awareness raising element of your mission too?
Yeah, it absolutely did. I think one of the big things that you find when you go up into the Arctic, whether it's on the Norwegian coast or up in Svalbard, is that everyone living there is acutely aware of what's going on around them. Whereas, you know, down here on the south coast of England or around the Med or the Caribbean, we might not be as in tune to what's happening up in the Arctic. So it did sort of boost that ambition to try and spread awareness and link people to what's happening up there better. But also to help the charities Polar Bears International and Ocean Conservancy with what they're doing. And that's what this whole campaign has always been based about, you know, is both raising awareness and helping NGOs that are out there trying to fight for a better future for the Arctic. So yeah, it really did bring all that home for me. And I think that's partly what has given me the boost and the energy to keep going through yet another winter shipyard refit to be able to get out there and really highlight what I'm trying to showcase next year.
And given that this was also a bonding session between you and Yeva, your boat, right? I mean, that's an incredibly personal relationship. Did you notice, aside from obviously the opportunities for fixes like the anchor locker and the rudder fixing, did you notice Yeva operate differently in that environment at all? I know that sounds like an odd question, but I'm just thinking about, you know, the density of cold air in comparison to warmth. I mean, that does change the way you sail, right?
Yeah, it does. Bear in mind, like I said, we were up there in August this year and it was unbelievably warm to sort of record new highs. So we haven't yet had the sort of ice in the water experience that we'll be getting around the Northwest Passage and Greenland next summer. But Yeva handled the conditions beautifully. She's got a chined hull, which was amazing in the larger offshore seas. She's not so good in choppy waters trying to head up a fjord or a river. She's quite crap. Choppy and close.
I think that's fair, Ella. You know?
Yeah, it's helped me get to know how to sail her, obviously, because we've only done sort of shorter passages around the south coast of England before this big trip. And now we've done well over 3,500 miles single-handed. And one of the things I really had to, you know, sort of urge myself to keep doing was to shake out a reef, you know, let her have more sail plan. I forget that she's a heavier, slower boat. So it's helped me, yeah, fine-tune my sail trim and sailing on her as well. But I've got every confidence in her and I always have, despite the issues we had this year. So now that both of those have been fixed, yeah, I'm going to take some time off over Christmas to see my family and then hopefully get back out in January and go sailing on my baby boat again.
I'm sure you're looking forward to it, eh?
Well, like, yeah, it's very strange living in a house again after being on board for 2 years, only temporarily while she's out of the water.
Well, I think on that note, and in the spirit of well-deserved rest, of which you, more than most of us after this year, are perhaps in need of, particularly in view of your adventures upcoming. Ella, it's always such a pleasure and very much look forward to us discussing further over the course of next year your adventures, what you find out about yourself, your boat, and as importantly, the ecosystem up north as you find out.
Thank you so much for having me back. And yeah, I can't wait to have another chat.
Ella Hibbett, solo sailor and next year attempting the world first non-stop circumnavigation of the Arctic Circle. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Clean Sailors podcast. For information on all episodes and for more about Clean Sailors, head to cleansailors.com. Thank you for listening and see you for the next episode.